A moment of truce in Syria, today on The World. Russia and Turkey say they've made a deal, so the threatened assault on the Syrian city of Idlib looks like it's on hold, at least for now.
What is the end game? Still unclear, because Assad has said he's going to take back every inch of Syrian territory, and Russia said that they would help him do that.
And following the example of U.S. universities, the first British university has looked into its history to find out how it benefited from the slave trade.
Whether the university made $10 million in today's money or $100 million in today's money, I think is less important than accepting the principle that it benefited and that we have to acknowledge that and decide what we want to be and do about it as a response.
Those stories and much more today here on The World. Marco Werman here with The World. Good to have you spending some time with us. We're going to start the show off with some developments in the war in Syria. It's been grinding on for 7 years now. At this point, Idlib in the north of Syria on the Turkish border, it's the last rebel stronghold in the country. And President Bashar al-Assad recently announced a major offensive on the city. But there is word today of an agreement between Russia and Turkey for a demilitarized buffer zone around Idlib. We're going to hear more about that in a few minutes. There are 3 million people living in Idlib, and some of them have already been displaced from other parts of Syria, where Bashar al-Assad's government has taken control. Reporter Rasha Elas has been following one Syrian family for the past 5 years, 30-year-old Mohammed Hamedan and his wife and children. They're in Idlib now, but they used to live in the outskirts of Damascus.
In October of 2013, I smuggled myself into a rebel-held area of Damascus called Ghouta. I had arrived there after a massive gas attack killed 1,700 people, many as they slept. I first met Mohammed Hamedan in the streets of Ghouta. He was 25 years old at the time and had survived the chemical attack because he lived a few miles from where it happened. He showed me the neighborhoods where the apartment buildings were destroyed from repeated government airstrikes.
The devastation of one building is difficult to describe in words, but half the building is gone. There's a washing machine. There's half a kitchen that's visible with cabinets that are blackened. There are pots and pans.
We go around the block and he shows me his own apartment, which had recently been bombed and reduced to rubble. Mohammed had been living in this rebel-held area for a few months, but he grew up on a farm over 100 miles north of here. He had been doing his military service in Assad's army when the civil war broke out. Then he defected to the rebel side. Inside another apartment, we shared a meal with other rebel fighters. It consisted of a few olives, a piece of bread, and a fried egg. In rebel-controlled Ghouta, food and supplies were scarce. And for the first time in my life, I experienced hunger. As we ate, Mohammed played revolutionary music, and the shelling outside didn't stop. A few months ago, Assad's forces took back Ghouta and some 40,000 Syrians were forced to evacuate. They rode in buses under Russian military escort for 200 miles north, all the way to Idlib, the last rebel territory in Syria. Mohammed and his wife, Bayan, and their two toddlers were among them.
Ahlan, Rasha.
I recently reached Mohammed and his family on Skype. He and his wife told me the journey to Idlib was a difficult one. Along the way, regime supporters threw rocks at us and made threatening and rude gestures. As we chat, 3-year-old Maria can be heard babbling in the background. In Idlib, Mohammed reunited with his parents for the first time since he joined the rebellion. His mother told me that she felt joy, but also sadness. Her brother and his pregnant wife and their 6 children were detained by the regime and have since disappeared, and 2 of her nephews were killed in the fighting.
يعني كانت فرحتي كتير كبيرة وقت اللي إجا أخي وابني بس كنت مصدومة فعلا يعني.
I was so happy to see my brother and son after 6 years, she says. But I really feel devastated because after all that struggle, it was all for nothing. So many lives have been lost for nothing. Mohammed and his family have made a life in Idlib. His father has opened a grocery store and his mother is a seamstress. Until recently, life in Idlib has been relatively peaceful. But Assad's forces are closing in to take this last rebel-controlled area of Syria. And Mohammed says everything will change. At this moment, there are no airstrikes here, he says. The warplanes are bombing farther south, but at any minute they can come back, and people believe a chemical attack is imminent. We just don't know exactly when. The ground in Idlib is rocky, so the houses have no basements. If the bombing does come, there will be no place for the family to hide. For The World, I'm Rasha Elas.
Rasha spoke with the Hamedan family last week before today's announcement from Russia and Turkey. The two countries say they've agreed to establish a demilitarized buffer zone around Idlib. And a reminder of what's at stake. The United Nations says there are nearly 3 million people in Idlib, and it's worried there would be a humanitarian catastrophe if the Assad government launches an all-out attack. That attack may now be on hold. Josh Landis is director of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I asked him about the announcement today from Russia and Turkey.
Well, there are several things. One is they're both claiming that they have averted an invasion, at least for now, and that they're going to set up a demilitarized zone that is 15 to 20 kilometers wide that will be policed both by Turkish troops and Russian troops, and that the Al-Qaeda connected groups and HTS, this what used to be Nusra, have to be decommissioned and withdrawn from the region. And that's going to be the real challenge. It's not clear what happens to the other groups. There are many groups that are linked to Turkey now in what's called the National Liberation Front. Will they be permitted to stay? They have to give up their heavy weapons. So this is contingent on Turkey being able to get all the rebels to give up their heavy weapons, plus the jihadist rebels that haven't been cooperating with Turkey, to decommission. That's a big job. So far, Turkey has been unable to do it. But everybody who wants to delay this invasion has been saying, you've got to give more time to Turkey to work on the rebels and to try to come to an understanding with them to lay down their arms.
What do you think of the feasibility of this plan, of this DMZ?
Well, it takes the pressure off for the time being. The entire international community has been demanding more time, that Russia give Turkey more time to work on these rebels. And that's what this does. So in a sense, what Russia is doing is throwing the hot potato back into Turkey's hands and saying, okay, we're not obstructionist here. We're not bloodthirsty. We understand there's a dilemma, but you have to fix the situation. What is the end game? Still unclear, because Assad has said he's going to take back every inch of Syrian territory. And Russia said that they would help him do that. So this all, at least today, seems like an interim situation in which Turkey has to do a lot of the heavy lifting. Now, of course, Russia has to get Syria to call off the dogs and to not invade, even though they say that they're ready to do it. So that's the situation today. We're going to see how this works out and whether this is just posturing by all sides in order to delay a little bit.
Why would Turkey want to do this?
Because there are three million people in this little province. They're all bottled up there. It's been the dumping ground for all these rebels. If Syria and Russia move in and take this back, there's going to be a flood of refugees. Jihadists will be scattered across Anatolia, and Turkey will be left holding the bag inside Anatolia, which would be terrible for it. It'd have to hunt these people down. Better for them to contain it in this small province, try to set up a demilitarized zone, protect them, and sort of contain the problem from a Turkish point of view so that it doesn't become a Turkish problem. It remains a Syrian problem.
If Bashar al-Assad were to win the battle against the rebels in Idlib, I mean, hasn't he basically won the war in Syria? So why blink now?
Because Russia is holding his arms, and because the world is threatening things. We don't know quite what. Assad is not finished with this. He is going to put the pressure on again. There are going to be infractions. It's very unclear whether al-Qaeda types will get rid of their guns. They've said that they will not do it. That's been their line in the past. I don't know what's happened to change that. Obviously, Turkey, which is in communication with all these various rebel groups and jihadist groups, is going to have to lay down a law and tell them, look, it, if you really refuse now, or at that, you know, the 11th hour, if you refuse now, Syria's going to conquer you, and we're not going to stop them.
Can Russia make Assad comply with this deal?
I think that Russia can. And you know, Russia is telling Syria that at the end of the day, Syria is going to regain sovereignty over its territory. That's what Syria wants to hear. Syria can put it off for a few more months. This war has dragged on for 7 years. It doesn't have to happen tomorrow. But Syria does not want to see the country divided up between Turkey, United States, Kurds, so forth. That's what Assad has said he will not put up with. And he'll have to deliver on that sooner or later.
How is the U.S. going to view this deal?
I think the U.S. is sighing a big sigh of relief. It means that there isn't this massive refugee problem. Assad is restrained. Russia's in a whole heap of difficulties because it's got to try to deliver on this. And it puts the pressure on Turkey. And America's relations with Turkey have not been very good. America doesn't want to see these rebels scattered into Anatolia and perhaps Europe and other places. So this is good news for the United States. I think U.S. will be gratified, and I think that they have played a part in bringing this about by putting pressure on Russia and Assad not to do anything rash.
So if you're one of those civilians, like the family we just heard from in Idlib, you must also be breathing a sigh of relief, at least for a few months anyway.
Absolutely. And it's good news. It's good news because it means Turkey is remaining very actively present. Many of the civilians do not like the rebel groups. They certainly don't like the al-Qaeda rebel groups who've made their life fairly miserable and who are, you know, collecting money and so forth. Many of the civilians would like Turkey and the state of Turkey to play a much bigger role in the future in order to raise the quality of life, bring electricity, bring schools, and raise the standard of living in Idlib province. That's what they would like to see. There are others who would like Syrian government to restore sovereignty over the region. But for the time being, this is a great sigh of relief, and it's certainly going to relieve the pressure. But it doesn't solve the larger problem of what's going to ultimately happen to this province.
Josh Landis, Director of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Thank you, as always.
A pleasure.
Before we go to a short break, I want to tell you about a story we'll have for you tomorrow. A politician and musician tortured for his stand against authoritarian rule in Uganda. Bobby Wine had to seek medical attention right here in Boston. He saw doctors, and for the past week, he's been traveling between Boston and Washington, meeting Ugandan expats who support him and holding town meetings on what's going on back home. We'll report on his stop in Boston, where he thanked a ballroom packed with Ugandan supporters for literally saving his life.
I must say that maybe I wouldn't be alive if you did not exert the pressure that you exerted. You guys may not know, but you actually saved my life. You enabled me to travel here, but you continue to save the lives of the people back home.
I sit down for a conversation with Bobby Wine at a hotel in Waltham, Massachusetts, a place I have since learned is known by some as Little Kampala. That's tomorrow, right here on The World. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Georgetown, Brown, the University of Virginia, all schools that have been looking back at how they benefited from the international slave trade. No surprise that's led to some tough questions here and in schools beyond our borders. The first British university has now come out with a report about how much it benefited from slavery, Glasgow University in Scotland. The World's Rupa Shenoy has been following the story for us. Today she spoke with Professor Simon Newman, who is one of the co-authors of the report and was inspired to investigate by recent moves taken by American universities.
A lot of American universities have looked into their past following the first major one at Brown University. And it sounds like that was also a catalyst for your investigation.
Very much so. We were very interested in how American universities have been addressing this history of how they may or may not have benefited from racial slavery. And because the University of Glasgow has long been proud of its history of abolitionism and emancipation and support for the end of slavery, but was in a city which grew rich on the profits of slavery, we thought, well, there's probably a story to be told here too.
But you didn't know that going into it, did you?
No, but we did know. Every time I went to a graduation ceremony and the university students who were getting degrees walked up, the role of benefactors of the university was read out, and one of them was James Ewing, Jamaica merchant.
The name was of a slave trader?
Yes, and not just that. The University of Glasgow is one of the six ancient universities, the medieval universities in Britain, and it's the only one that's in a port city. And it's a port city that grew very wealthy on the profits from tobacco and then sugar and cotton. So a lot of money came into the city, and the university went from being a very small college to a major university at the same time. So it seemed sensible to think that some of that money probably made its way to the university.
So how'd you go about finding out?
It's a very complicated research process because although there are examples where it's very clear, so for example, Robert Cunningham Graham, who was a student at the university, had no money at all, but he made a fortune in Jamaica, came back to Scotland, was elected rector of the university by the students, and then gave a gift. He made his money from slavery, and it's obvious. So we can say that money he gave is directly related to slavery. But in many cases, it's much more indirect. It's, if a gift was made to the university in 1870 to help build the new campus, well, where had that money come from? Did the father of the person who gave the money receive compensation when Britain compensated all slave owners when they abolished slavery in the Caribbean in the 1830s? Had the great-grandfather or great-great-grandfather made money in the tobacco trade? And had some of that money come? So sometimes it's a very complicated story. And when we say, depending on the scale you use, it's anything from 16.6 million in today's money to 198.6 million. We're not necessarily saying all of the money came from slavery, but we're saying the profits of slavery are in there.
Why did you feel like it was important to come up with an estimate when a lot of universities have kind of avoided doing that kind of thing?
Well, we knew that in Britain we were breaking new ground, and that it would be very important to explain why we thought this was a part of our history that we needed to talk about, but also to provide the evidence. And we thought that the dollars and cents, the pounds and shillings totals would actually really matter here, however imprecise they are, that it would show people, oh, this is something we can't ignore. This is actually quite a big thing.
Okay, and you're responding with your report with the restorative justice program. Can you describe what that entails?
Yes, we're going to increase our efforts to increase student and staff diversity to better reflect the diversity of the British population, but also the descendants of enslaved people. And that's primarily people of African descent, but not exclusively. There were South Asian people who were enslaved, and Britain profited from that as well. We're very excited about developing a very close relationship with the University of the West Indies in ways that will benefit their students and staff, but also I suspect will benefit ours too. So that will be a big thing coming out of this. The university will create a center for the study of slavery, both historical and present-day trafficking, acknowledging that this is not an institution that's disappeared. And then the campus itself, existing buildings which are connected, so the main building of the University of Glasgow, this fantastic Gothic building, the Gilbert Scott Building, is built on the site of a slave owner's house and was built in part by these gifts in the 1860s and 70s, many of which were connected to slavery. So we'll have signage to reflect that, and one of the new buildings that will be constructed in the next couple of years will be named for an enslaved person, possibly James McCune Smith, who was the first African-American to receive a medical degree, and he received it at Glasgow, but maybe someone else.
What has the response been like? Because in this country, some people have responded to reports like this from American universities by saying, you know, we shouldn't be judging the past by today's morals.
It's a really difficult question, isn't it? But I think the very fact that even at the time these gifts were made, some people in the university were saying slavery is wrong. So we're not imposing our values from the present. We're looking back at them and saying the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing or didn't ask too many questions. And that may be one of the reasons we've forgotten this since.
But it doesn't sound like you found much evidence of them at the time acknowledging that contradiction.
No, I don't think so. I think it was such a part of the fabric of the city, the trade in tobacco, the trade in sugar, the trade in cotton. The men who made wealth became the major figures in the city, the major benefactors, setting up museums and charitable institutions. It would be hard to imagine a university at the time saying, we don't want your money.
What's the university's diversity like now among its students?
Increasing all the time. We have a long way to go because it was a very white student body when I arrived, but that is changing.
And what has been the response from the diverse student population? Because in this country, it has been seen as a really important issue, in mm-hmm. part because of things like Black Lives Matter, and then also
yes.
because of the ongoing issue of police shootings of black men. They thought it was also important at the same time to make the link from history to the present.
Yes. During this whole process of researching this history, we were working with the Black History Month Committee and with other committees and groups on campus, which included minority students. They were part of the process of creating this.
And do you hope that you're the beginning of a trend, that Glasgow is the beginning of universities in Britain looking at their past like this?
Yes, I do hope so. If universities can't do this, if we can't be honest about who we are and where we came from and how we want to be better going forward, then I'm not sure what institutions can.
Colonialism is also a big deal for Britain as well, right? So is there any plan to perhaps look at that history?
Well, it's a good question, and it's a vast subject. And coming from Glasgow, which proudly calls itself the second city of the empire, or has in the past called itself that, it's a very appropriate question. I think that does need to be done, but it's such a vast subject. How do we address that, and who addresses that? There is more and more research being done, more and more teaching in those areas. And as more and more global history is taught at places like Glasgow, I think this is the way forward, and that there will be these kinds of investigations. But hopefully what we've done is a start for that.
Yeah, colonialism is another vast subject. Maybe that comes next. But dealing with slavery now is a start, as the professor said. That was The World's Rupa Shenoy speaking with Simon Newman, a professor at Glasgow University in Scotland, just starting to look at how that school benefited from the slave trade. I'm Marco Werman. As the Carolinas cope with the impact of Hurricane Florence, people in the Philippines are dealing with landslides from a typhoon.
A big portion of the mountain, after being deluged by both the storm and the monsoon rains for the past month, slid down and buried a mining settlement.
That's still to come right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Heavy rains and flash flooding continue over the Carolinas and could spread north all the way to Pennsylvania as Florence continues to wring itself out over the eastern U.S. Meanwhile, parts of Southeast Asia are confronting the effects of another massive storm. Super Typhoon Mangkhut inundated Hong Kong and other parts of southern China over the weekend. In the Philippines, where the storm is known as Ompong, more than 60 people died amid heavy rains and winds of up to 100 miles an hour. Aurora Almendral is a reporter, and she's covering Typhoon Mangkhut in the northern Philippines. You recently saw recovery efforts underway at a mining settlement. Tell us what happened there and what you saw, Aurora.
Really, the day after the typhoon hit, there was a mining settlement several hours south of where the eye of the typhoon passed through. So we didn't expect the level of casualties that happened at this landslide area. A big portion of the mountain, after being deluged by both the storm and the monsoon rains for the past month, slid down and buried a mining settlement. They had two long bunkhouses and about 70 or so people next to a gold mining site were completely buried. And I was at the site today, and the bunkhouses are not visible in any way. And what I've been told by the miners who were helping with the rescue efforts is that the floor of the bunkhouse was now 20 feet below where we were standing on mud.
That's one snapshot of the horrible destruction of Typhoon Mangkhut. And across the islands, can you give us a sense of destruction elsewhere in the Philippines? What have you seen?
I started covering the storm up north near where the eye of the storm passed. And I saw crop damage, building damage, down power lines, trees that were down. Some of the main cities up there had quite a bit of visible damage. The government stationed rescue operations near where they expected to be very bad, so that even though a whole section of the Philippines was out of communication for something like 15 hours, they were able to deal with the typhoon damage up there.
Aurora, what are you hearing from people who have been affected by the typhoon? What's rebuilding going to look like for them?
I think that the main part that people are concerned about is the agricultural damage. The buildings are relatively manageable, but that part of the Philippines is considered the breadbasket of the Philippines. So a lot of crops are being grown there. And even as the storm was coming towards the Philippines, many farmers were sort of hurrying to harvest what they could. And so what they're really worried about now is the sort of long-term crop damage that will affect prices in the Philippines, vegetable availability. And so I think most of the damage that's concerning to both individuals and the government is crops.
So in 2013, the Philippines was hit hard by Haiyan, also known as Super Typhoon Yolanda, and that caused massive destruction and loss of life. How would you compare this typhoon with Haiyan?
I think the destruction of this typhoon has been far, far less than Haiyan, even though the strength has been comparable. They're both super typhoons, but there weren't storm surges like we saw in Haiyan. Storm surge is essentially a typhoon-induced tsunami. And I think that a lot of people didn't evacuate and there was far less preparation. A lot of hard lessons have been learned since Haiyan.
Yeah, tell us about some of those lessons, especially in terms of agriculture, which you've suggested is going to be the tough one to rebuild. Were preparation and recovery efforts different this time because of what was learned from Super Typhoon Haiyan?
Yeah, I think that what we saw in the wake of Haiyan is that everybody takes a big typhoon like this seriously now. So when people are said to evacuate coastal areas, that there's a danger of storm surges, don't go outside, I think people, you know, remember what happened in Haiyan and take heed. The other thing is that the government seems to be better at pre-positioning the relief goods so they can get to the people as needed. As far as crop damage goes, I think that that's not something that you can really avoid. This is something that really feeds into the cyclical poverty of people who are living in the areas that are heavily affected by the typhoons, because there's not a lot you can do about it when a typhoon tears up your fields.
Reporter Aurora Almendral speaking with us from Itogan in the northern Philippines. Thanks very much, Aurora, and stay safe.
Thank you very much, Marco.
Typhoon Mangkhut, as well as Hurricane Florence here in the U.S., would have been big and damaging storms regardless of when they'd have happened. But atmospheric scientists say it's clear that the greenhouse gas pollution we've been pumping into the atmosphere is making storms like these even more destructive. Kerry Emanuel is a professor of atmospheric science at MIT and a leading expert on the impacts of climate change on tropical cyclones, or typhoons as they call them in the Pacific, hurricanes here in the Atlantic. Professor Emanuel, it was a few years ago that we last spoke, and it was right after Haiyan had hit the Philippines. And you had just run a study that found that storms, winds were likely 30 to 40% more destructive than they would have been before the warming of the last few decades. So what about these current storms? Do you have a sense of how much more powerful they've been in terms of wind, rain, storm surge, the whole thing, than, say, if they had hit 30 years ago?
Yes, we have. And in particular, we looked at storms of the kind Florence was striking North Carolina. And we see that the frequency of a windstorm of that magnitude has gone up actually by several factors since the 20th century. And more worrisome, the amount of rain, or I should say the frequency of rains of the magnitude we're now seeing in North Carolina has already increased perceptibly. So we are worried, and we have been worried for about 30 years about this.
So the same dynamics you see at play in the Philippines and in the southeast of the U.S.?
That's right. Now, when we look at this, it's far from globally uniform. As a matter of fact, we see a little bit less change in the southern Philippines, a place that was affected by Haiyan, than we see in the sort of subtropical regions like North Carolina. Those places seem, their risk seems to be increasing a bit faster there.
So in general, how would you say our understanding of the relationship between climate change and big storms like these is advancing?
The conclusions from based on a whole bunch of different studies, not just the ones that I do, really are converged on a couple of things. One is that the incidence of high intensity events in general should go up. the rain produced by a given storm should go up quite a bit, and we're beginning to see that in the data. And related to that, we expect to see greater incidence of coastal flooding from storm surges, which are driven by the wind and exacerbated by sea level rise, and of course, inland flooding from torrential rains.
So speaking about data, you probably know that for several years until recently, North Carolina basically banned the use of contemporary data and forecasts on sea level rise, i.e. data that takes climate change into account. So how do you think the impact of Florence and the state's preparedness for it might have been different if they'd had a reality-based policy in place the last few years?
Well, I'm not sure how different it would be. Clearly, such policies are fairly foolish, I'd have to say. I think you have to look at policies like that in the context of much larger scale policies that have been in place for decades, which have been truly devastating. The bottom line is that state governments and the federal government massively subsidize risk-taking in the coast. And the number one problem is the National Flood Insurance Program, which was implemented in 1968 and has been subjected to a great deal of political pressure from developers and coastal homeowners who, as a result, get insurance premiums that don't begin to reflect the actual risk that they voluntarily undertake. To make the program work, their risk is subsidized by people, generally poorer people who live in less risky places. So by subsidizing risk, it's not surprising that we've seen massive development of the coastline. And for that reason, even if the climate were not changing at all, we would see all kinds of Katrinas and Florences and Harveys going forward as far as the eye can see.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point, and one wonders what it must be like for people who get completely flooded out of their homes in places where they don't have any insurance. So if that's North Carolina, and we're hearing that the Philippines is better prepared this time than they were in 2013 for Haiyan, does that suggest that the Philippines is keeping careful track of the data and the climate science, or did they get lucky this time?
Well, you know, I think one has to understand in the first place that the Philippines get hammered by Category 5 typhoons very frequently compared to the United States. They don't have in place the policies I just described, and for that reason, there isn't a lot of development of the east-facing coast, which gets battered by typhoons, and so the towns that get damaged are further inland. But yes, the government certainly learned some lessons from Haiyan and did much more by way of evacuation in the face of this latest typhoon.
Kerry Emanuel, professor of atmospheric science at MIT, thanks very much.
You're quite welcome.
In Germany, the far-right party, Alternative for Deutschland, has been climbing in popularity. It's actually polling in first place in what used to be East Germany. Daniela Czeslow recently met with some AfD supporters in the eastern part of the country to find out why the party's anti-immigrant message seems to resonate there.
40 miles south of Berlin, AfD state representative Birgit Bessin is crisscrossing her district. She's got a trailer with her face printed on the side. And she offers coffee to anyone coming by.
We want to speak to a person from the tiny, small, sweet villages who perhaps not come to our bigger events in other states.
Her district in Brandenburg is home to 165,000 people, including about 2,500 refugees and migrants. The area has been recognized by an American NGO for its success in integrating newcomers. Yet some people here are uneasy with their new neighbors. They say migrants bring crime and have harassed women on the street. It's a battle cry for the AfD. Here's Bessin at a recent rally near here. In the past, feminism was a matter for the left, she says. Today, we, the Alternative for Deutschland, are protecting the rights, freedom, and security of women and children. Refugees and asylum seekers made up 15% of violent crime suspects in Germany last year, though they were only 2% of the population. One criminologist I spoke to questioned whether that number is skewed because Germans may be more likely to report an incident when a refugee is involved. But the fear is driving up support for the AfD.
Hello.
A man in jeans and an orange button-down shirt approaches the trailer. I catch him as he comes out.
You spent a long time in that truck.
Yes, maybe. It's my village, and I had a lot of questions.
He tells me his name is Thomas. He doesn't want to give his last name because he works with the local government.
Das größte Thema, was momentan ist, ist die Flüchtlingskrise.
He says his main concern is the refugee crisis. Thomas says he used to talk with the newcomers in town.
I met a Pakistani person and it was okay. We chit-chatted and it was nice.
Ja, also wir haben zum Beispiel unbegleitete Jugendliche.
But a lot of the migrants are young men, he says, and they hit on girls, including one of his daughters. He says in 2016, one migrant fatally stabbed another. The suspect got off on self-defense. The next year, he says he heard of a brawl in another nearby town, where six foreigners attacked a German and broke his leg. Thomas thinks the AfD is the only party that's paying attention to this. He used to vote for the CDU, the party of Angela Merkel, but he says they've moved too far to the left.
Wenn ich das Parteiprogramm von der CDU noch hörte von vor 10 Jahren.
The AfD's popularity is up in Brandenburg, even as the party is under pressure after a few of its leaders appeared at a protest in Chemnitz, not too far from here. The protest was sparked by the murder of a German man, allegedly by two migrant men. But it turned violent, and some of the demonstrators were filmed making the Hitler salute. That's illegal in Germany, and Thomas says those people should be punished.
So dumm kann man nicht sein, jetzt wenn jetzt so eine Sache ist, sich vor einer Kamera hinzustellen.
How stupid do you have to be that you show the Hitler salute in the public when TV cameras are in front of you?
But then he offers, without any evidence, maybe those people were left-wing plants who came to discredit the demonstration and shut down the conversation about migrant crime. A few steps from Bessin's trailer, I meet two bicyclists from Berlin sharing a beer from the local pub. Jörg Götze and Matthias Voigt worry about the AfD.
Die AfD ist verbunden mit den Rechtsnationalen.
Rechtsextremen, richtig heftige Nazis.
The AfD is connected with right-wing nationalists, Götze says. Real, violent Nazis, Voigt says. And that frightens me, because when I think of German history, the danger of it repeating itself, of the Third Reich, is definitely there. If these people come to power, it will be no laughing matter for minorities.
Die uns oder dich erwartet, wenn du hier übernachtest.
But the people here, who are attracted to the AfD, don't see it as scary. They see Birgit Bessin's friendly face on the blue trailer and an open door. For The World, Daniela Czeslo, Kolzenburg.
Still ahead on the show, Sweden retires its citizen-run Twitter feed. You're listening to The World. Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's something we've been covering on the show ever since Donald Trump entered the White House, the shrinking ranks of the State Department. On the same day a few months back that Mike Pompeo took over from Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State, we had writer Ronan Farrow on the show talking about what he'd seen at the State Department in Trump's first year.
Tillerson really laid waste to this department. You know, this is an embattled workforce, brave men and women who serve in crappy places around the world with terrible security situations and not enough pay, and they do it to save American lives and prevent dangerous people from coming into our country and to cut the deals that hopefully keep our servicemen and women out of the line of fire.
We're hearing today in an exclusive Reuters report that Mike Pompeo is in the process of wooing back diplomats whom his predecessor offended. Arshad Mohammed wrote the story.
Rex Tillerson had alienated a lot of the American diplomatic corps by doing a bunch of things, slashing promotions, embracing budget cuts that President Trump wanted to make at the State Department, freezing hiring, and probably most importantly, by making the American Foreign Service feel like he really wasn't consulting them and didn't take them very seriously. Pompeo is trying to reverse almost all of that. And what I found on the promotion numbers was that in three of the four top categories, he's increased promotions. In two cases, he's almost doubled the number of promotions from last year, and in one, it's up 50%. This is part of his sort of charm offensive, as it were.
Right. So diplomats of the State Department have to be feeling somewhat good about this. What about Mike Pompeo himself? Like, in terms of management style, is that also changing? Because a lot of people had criticisms of Rex Tillerson being very isolated, not really connecting with the diplomats and the State Department staff.
I mean, that's true. Tillerson was very much seen as somebody who was distant. And so he would, for example, hold weekend brainstorming or blue sky sessions with people, but on given topics, he wouldn't include, you know, the key person handling the country in question. I mean, so if they were having a discussion about Indonesia, he wouldn't necessarily have the U.S. ambassador to Indonesia on the line. I'm just making that up because I don't want to out anybody. But probably the single most powerful thing for an American diplomat is to feel that their boss actually cares what they know or think or analyze. And Tillerson left a lot of people with the impression that he didn't. Pompeo is engaging much more seriously. So I'll give you one example. He has, I'm told, he has gone down from the seventh floor where his fancy offices are to meet in the bureaus with some of the regional diplomats. And so I'm told he's gone to the East Asian and Pacific Affairs Bureau, for example, to do kind of a mini town hall. That's a way of telling people they're important. That's a big stylistic, but in some ways also kind of a substantive difference.
How much do you think Mike Pompeo is doing this charm offensive, as you put it, as a spin in the face of some fairly public resignations of ambassadors? And how much seems to be a concerted effort on his part to strengthen a weakened State Department?
You know, I think it's both. One thing to remember about Pompeo is that, I mean, there are a couple things to know about him. One, obviously, he began his career in the U.S. Army, so he has an experience of one very large American bureaucracy and a place where morale and esprit de corps are important. Second, he was a congressman, and members of the House understand nothing better than the importance of winning people over to their side since they're up for re-election every 2 years. And finally, he also ran the CIA, where, you know, it's another very tetchy U.S. bureaucracy. So my sense is that he has a much more instinctive feel for the importance of maintaining the strength of his part of the bureaucratic turf. Is part of it spin? Sure. But, you know, even if American diplomats understand that they're being spun to some degree, it's at least better to have a boss who thinks you're worth spinning than to have a boss who thinks it's not worth the time.
Arshad Mohammed with Reuters in Washington. Thanks very much for your time.
Marco, thank you. Nice to be with you.
There are lots of ways to do diplomacy. Here's one way Sweden has been doing it. For the past 7 years, it's farmed out its @Sweden Twitter account to members of the Swedish public. They could tweet just about anything they wanted to over the course of 1 week. Sweaters, moose hunting, politics, you name it. They did it. And hundreds of Swedes have done it. But now Sweden is pulling the plug on its citizen-run Twitter account. Anna Rudels is with the Swedish Institute, one of the government agencies involved in the project. So before we get to why this ended, what was the rationale behind this project in the first place?
At Sweden actually started as an idea to paint a more unique and authentic picture of Sweden. And of course, also to show that Sweden is an open and democratic country.
So give me some examples, if you would, of the tweets you would get.
It's been very, very different. We've had everything from football players, librarians, comedians, researchers, musicians. But I would say maybe one of my own personal favorite is one curator from this summer. He reported about the birth of his triplets.
Mm. Well, I mean, that's a nice shining example. But I gather you also had some curators for the Twitter account that were pretty provocative.
Yes, of course. I mean, we've had some that have been perceived as too maybe religious or too political. So that's when the account has raised more interest.
Interest in not necessarily a good way, it sounds like, from what you're saying.
Yeah, it depends. Still, I think that's kind of the strength of the account as well, that it is very open. And every curator by itself paints the picture of Sweden.
So why end the project?
What we see is that we have a bit of a limited geographical reach. Today we have mostly followers from the US, from the UK and Sweden. And I want to say it's not that those followers are not important. Of course they are. But we need to reach further and broader than that.
What would you say, Anna, is the main thing you learned from this experiment?
I would say the main thing is actually to be real and to be authentic. We have had let go of control.
I'm wondering if you have one favorite tweet that says something about Sweden that truly does kind of capture Swedish authenticity.
Well, this is kind of Swedish because it's not very Swedish. one journalist, he wrote that I am Sweden, and the views and opinions expressed in these tweets are shared by the entire Swedish population, or they should be. That is not a very Swedish way to do it. We're more, I mean, you shouldn't talk for others. But he had a very kind of humoristic angle to his week as a curator.
Anna Rudell is the head of communication for the Swedish Institute. That is the government agency in Stockholm that started the @Sweden Twitter account. Thank you very much. Good to speak.
Thank you very much.
From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. I tweet, by the way, @MarcoWerman, and it's me, only me, curating it. That's it for today. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.